When Ish-bosheth, son of Saul, heard that Abner had died in Hebron, he lost courage and all Israel became alarmed. Now Saul's son had two men who were leaders of raiding bands. One was named Bana and the other Rechab. They were sons of Rimmon and Berathite from the tribe of Benjamin. Berath is considered part of Benjamin because the people of Berath fled to Gidom and have lived there as aliens to this day. Jonathan, son of Saul, had a son who was lame in both feet. He was 5 years old when the news about Saul and Jonathan came from Jezreel. His nurse picked him up and fled, but as he hurried to leave, he fell and became crippled. His name was Mishpatheth. Now Rechab and Bana, the sons of Rimmon the Berathite, set out for the house of Ish-bosheth, and they arrived there in the heat of the day while he was taking his noonday rest. They went into the inner part of the house as if to get some wheat, and they stabbed him in the stomach. Then Rechab and his brother Bana slipped away. They had gone into the house while he was lying on the bed in his bedroom. After they stabbed and killed him, they cut off his head. Taking it with them, they traveled all night by way of Arabah. They brought the head of Ish-bosheth to David at Hebron and said to the king, "Here is the head of Ish-bosheth, son of Saul, your enemy, who tried to take your life. This day the Lord has avenged my lord the king against Saul and his offspring." David answered Rechab and his brother Bana, the sons of Rimmon, the Berathite, "As surely as the Lord lives, who has delivered me out of all trouble, when a man told me Saul is dead and thought he was bringing good news, I seized him and put him to death in Ziklag. That was the reward I gave him for his news. How much more, when wicked men have killed an innocent man in his own house and on his own bed, should I not now demand his blood from your hand and rid the earth of you?" So David gave an order to his men, and they killed them. They cut off their hands and feet and hung the bodies by the pool in Hebron. But they took the head of Ish-bosheth and buried it in Abner's tomb in Hebron. All the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and said, "We are your own flesh and blood. In the past, while Saul was king over us, you were the one who led Israel on their military campaigns. And the Lord said to you, 'You will shepherd my people Israel, and you will become their ruler.'" When all the elders of Israel had come to King David at Hebron, the king made a compact with them at Hebron before the Lord, and they anointed David king over Israel. David was 30 years old when he became king, and he reigned 40 years. In Hebron he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months, and Jerusalem he reigned over all Israel and Judah 33 years. The king and his men marched to Jerusalem to attack the Jebusites who lived there. The Jebusites said to David, "You will not get in here. Even the blind and the lame can ward you off." They thought, "David cannot get in here." Nevertheless, David captured the fortress of Zion, the city of David. On that day, David said, "Anyone who conquers the Jebusites will have to use the water shaft to reach those lame and blind who are David's enemies. That is why they say the blind and lame will not enter this place." David then took up residence in the fortress and called it the City of David. He built up the area around it from the supporting terraces inward. He became more and more powerful because the Lord God Almighty was with him.
Thank you, Bill. That was 2 Samuel chapter 4, as well as chapter 5 through verse 10. Any questions or comments regarding this section? Obviously, we see Ish-bosheth's murder, how David treats the individuals who killed him, as well as David's conquest, or started conquest, of Jerusalem. Any comments? Something catch your eye? Yes, Anne.
My question is on chapter 5, verse 8, about that last part. "Wherefore they say, the blind and the lame shall not come into the house."
Yes.
Is that to do with... It sounds contradictory, so you're going to go over that, I'm sure.
I'm going to have to go over that. My text words it a little differently than how Bill worded it. Unfortunately, this is a very obscure reference, as many references are when they start catching your attention. It's there for a reason, and we're going to talk about what some of the reasons could be. Not that I have the absolute answer, but we will discuss probably that in great detail in a few minutes. Any other comments or questions regarding this particular chapter? or chapter and a half. All right. Well, let's go through this. Verse 1, chapter 4. Saul's son Ishbosheth hears about the murder of Abner. Now, were Abner and Ishbosheth on good speaking grounds?
Yeah.
Not anymore. Abner was accused of sleeping with Saul's concubine by Ishbosheth. They split directions. Abner said, "I will turn you in to David, and you will be subject to him now." So Abner gathers all the people's forces, goes to David, says, "Hey, I'm going to get everybody to you because now I'm throwing my hat in with your ring." Abner, of course, is killed by Joab for the murder of Joab's brother, and that event never happens. But Ishbosheth and Abner had a falling out, a pretty significant one, such that they did not discuss or did not communicate again. So why would Ishbosheth be upset or concerned with Abner's death? Would he not want him killed? Would he not want him dead? And logically speaking, you would want him dead, logically speaking. But this is Ishbosheth. Logic is not part of his reasoning right now. We don't know much about him, but we do know a little bit. One of the things we do know about him is he is a powerless king. All of his power is based solely upon what Abner has given him. Not by God's mercy, not by God's granting of anything to Ishbosheth. It's strictly that Abner gathered all the people. Recall that Abner gathered many people as well as the Asherites. Recall we actually specifically refer to the Asherites as their own separate section of Israel, because they have so much cash and so much money from all the merchant work that they do. They are the ship bearers. Abner gathered them into Ishbosheth's line to support Ishbosheth with lots and lots of cash, which is great, what you want for a king, especially a newly established king. But Ishbosheth has no control. When anybody has a problem, Abner is the one who takes care of it. Abner is the one who wields all the authority. Why does Abner do this? Because of his loyalty to Saul and his anger, of course, with David. So Abner's death, Ishbosheth isn't upset because, oh, my poor friend has died. It's, oh no, now there's no way I will ever be king again. Or actually establish the kingdom over all of Israel. My power is for sure gone. But all of Israel gets shocked too. They're all surprised at Abner's death. Now we had learned from the previous chapter that when David found out that Abner was killed and Joab was the one who had done it, David, of course, curses Joab's brother, and it's the descendants of all of David's, all of Joab's father's line, not his mother, of course, Zeruiah is David's sister. So Abner is his nephew. But curses that line because of this murder of Abner, Joab's nephew. So David had nothing to do with it, but all of Israel, all they see is, all right, this one man who had so much power and influence over Israel is trying to get all the tribes together and trying to bring us over to David, and then David kills that man. That's all everybody else sees on the outside. Does that bring lots of confidence to you to say, oh, great, I'm going to go follow David down? Of course not. The one who is supposed to be bringing me to David, as far as they see, David murders, or has killed, as far as they're concerned. It takes a little while to realize what's going on here. And that, yes, there's a political issues, but as far as Abner's death, and David, of course, is mourning time, to say he requires everybody else, or you rip your clothing, the various things of the process of mourning over Abner's death indicate eventually to all of Israel that David didn't actually want Abner dead. But that still takes a little bit of time to get through and disseminate that belief to all of Israel. So with Ishbosheth, he gets murdered. Who murders him? Because when they hear Abner's dead, Abner was a power, right? So these two guys who are leaders of legions or chiefs of legions, they come along. What's the first thing going through their head now that their boss, Abner, is dead? Think about it. Ingratiate yourself, David. You've got to gain power because now your boss is gone and there's nobody you can now follow. That's it. You can't say, okay, now throw my loyalty to Ishbosheth. He has no influence. He has no power and he is diminishing. My best bet is throw my hat in with David. But how do I do that? Well, there's a unique, I can't remember which which person said this? I forgot. I'm paraphrasing a little bit. But the idea is, if you have a character flaw, your human natural instinct is to assume that everybody else has the same character flaw. So if you are compromised to taking bribes, you assume the vast majority, not everybody, will take a bribe. Just like you would. If you are compromised to, I'll kill this person for personal gain, you assume everybody else is compromised, say, I will kill this person for personal gain. So these men, they go decide, let's kill Ishbosheth. We don't like him anyway. He's not our boss. No big loss. But we'll kill him because it would have gained us power. We'll just bring him to David just so David will have the same mentality as we do. See, your enemy is dead. Now you have all this wonderful extra power. It's a common human trait. We all do it. To a different extent. We're not all murderers, by the way. I'm just saying that we all have that projected the idea that everybody has the same character flaw as we do. I hope we're not all murderers. In this particular section, chapter 4,
I just have a question. I know historically, I don't know if it was true at this point in time, but when there were kings over areas, the way of succession wasn't like David and Solomon. The way of succession was killing the leader and taking over. I don't know if that was true at that point in time or not, but
it's true in every culture at some point in time.
Yeah.
I mean, every culture has that problem at some point in their history, good or bad. Obviously, the Romans were well known for that issue. The Greeks had their issues of similar nature. The Canaanite kings in their area, some of them ran across that problem, not all, but some did, that they're the best way of, it wasn't necessarily the next person in line, let's say my eldest son, but instead of maybe my brother's son decided to, I want king, and then killed everybody and took king. Still genetic line, but not the original heir to the throne. Very common. Whether or not that's what these guys are thinking or not, couldn't tell you for certain. They are obviously relatives. They're all from the tribe of Benjamin. They're all relatives of Saul, though maybe very distant relatives. Whether their goal was to gain kingdom, I doubt it. Their goal, apparently, to me, appears to ingratiate themselves with David, which was apparently their motive. In this chapter, it discusses the other surviving heir to Saul's throne, the son of Jonathan, Ishbosheth. Mephibosheth. I can talk this, right? What happened to him? 5 years old, he was dropped, and it damaged his feet. We don't know what the damage was. Mostly they were broken. Somehow they were lame. He was no longer functional. Why is it important to list that here in this chapter? Well, how many heirs are there to Saul's throne? These are only two men left. We don't know how many kids, if any, Ishbosheth had. So far, it doesn't indicate any. So, the only two rightful heirs, Ishbosheth and Mephibosheth, in that order. Mephibosheth is listed out here, a description of what happened to him, indicating he is not fit to become a king. That's key, because if a king can't go to battle, you can't go to war, especially this time, you aren't a king. You're nothing. Now, you may go to war later on if you're super young and you get old enough, you become a war. That's fine. But this indicates that he is physically incapable or not able to become king. It's listed so that these two men who kill Ishbosheth are actually wiping out the rightful heirs of Saul's throne completely, even though they did not kill Jonathan's son. Didn't have to. She was running to injure him, right? Right. No, I understand that. See, but it's listed here. It could be listed at the time which right. The event happened, which it didn't. It's listed here now. Okay. It's listed here now to indicate, all right, with these two people, Ishbosheth and Mephibosheth, both of them are rightful heirs to Saul's throne, but only one is fit to be king. Ishbosheth, which is now dead. Mephibosheth is not fit to become king because of this event. It's listed here to indicate there is no one left of Saul's line. Save one. But he's not able to be king. It's important to point that out. So that when these two men kill Ishbosheth, and they go over to David and say, here's his head, they know, and David knows, all right, there is no one left that I contend with. There's no one left that Israel will throw their support behind. They're all gone, even though Ishbosheth is still alive. It's important to note that. It'll show up again later. With the deal with Mephibosheth and David and how they interact with one another and some of the deals they strike with each other. These two men, descendants from, Rimon, the Bithrophite? They don't really know where Beeroth is. It's just a guesstimate. They know it's somewhere, it's a border town between Ephraim, Benjamin, and Dan. So somewhere near those areas, they're not sure where it is. It's believed that Beeroth was actually in Ephraim's territory, though it was populated by Benjamites. Minor detail, except that they were one of the closest Benjamite cities to the Battle of Jezreel, which killed Saul and Jonathan. So to flee would be a very good thing in their eyes, because they're on the way back. As the Philistines, if the Philistines travel from the battle back home, they're going to cross Beeroth very, very easily. Why is this to skip town if you happen to be a descendant of Saul? Or, a relative of Saul. And of course, all these men are. I'm going to go this a little bit faster so I can get to chapter 5, because there's something in chapter 5 I really want to focus on our effort, which is what Anne brought up. They go in, they pose as either wheat merchants, they go in buying wheat. We're not sure how they got into the house. Either way, the guards were not concerned with them. My personal indication, they probably went in there posing as wheat merchants, although it's a little bit odd because being masters of legions, or charge of their own legion, they would have been known by Ishbosheth by face. He would have known them. So would all Ishbosheth's guards would have known them. So for them to pose, my sense, posing with as wheat merchants. I don't believe it's posing as wheat merchants. My inclination is more like they're posing with wheat merchants, or as his rendition was to buy or purchase wheat. It made more sense because Ishbosheth would have known who they were, and all the guards would have known who they were. So to pose something different is a little bit odd, or trying to mask them, their identity is odd. So not my personal text version. But anyway, they kill him, sever his head, somehow conceal that and escape. How they conceal that? Maybe they had a wheat bag. I don't know, threw his head inside of a bag. It's just wheat, yeah. It's a little red on the outside, but it's really not what you think it is. I don't know. Somehow they escaped. The travel says Arava, which means that they did not cross the Jordan where everybody else crossed. They went all the way down to the north of the Dead Sea to cross. Because along here, what do you run across? A very well-populated area that has lots and lots and lots of Ishbosheth supporters. On the other side of the Jordan, what do you run across? A very sparsely populated area that has very few supporters of anybody. They're mostly on their own. Easier to escape that way. They go to David. David compares them immediately to whom? The death of Saul, the Amalekite. Recall what the deal with Amalekite was. That Amalekite, he was claiming he was following orders from Saul himself to kill him. Amalekite came upon Saul, he was leaning on his sword, and said, please kill me. And the guy said, okay, if the king gives you an order, okay, I'll kill you, that's fine, so you're done. He runs to David thinking he's going to curry favor, it doesn't work. David says, you were not afraid to kill Saul, so you're dead. David kills him. Now, David compares these two to him. The difference is, the original guy at least was following orders. These two were just outright murderers. David doesn't bother asking any more details. If you recall correctly, with the original guy, the Amalekite, David asks him further questions. Give me the details. What was going on? David was inquiring and gathering information. These men, no, you're dead. Bye. I don't need to ask you questions. I don't need to compare if you for sure were murdering or... No, you're dead. You're history. These guys are gone, obviously. So their character flaw that they thought David would probably agree with was misplaced as far as the projection of it. Yes, Ellie.
There's also a difference between killing someone in battle who is has been fighting and going into someone's bedroom and killing him in cold blood.
Oh, right. This is straight up murder. This is straight up murder.
Big difference.
Right. And these men didn't try to conceal it. I mean, they didn't claim, there was something else going. They blatantly told him, well, here's his head. We killed him. They would have described how they did it because, note, who was writing the story down? David and his men. So how would they know this happened? Because these guys would have told them. How did they know these guys posed as wheat merchants? Because these guys would have told them, oh, we posed as wheat merchants, or posed as buying with wheat, or whatever the case would be. And we snuck in, we killed him, we severed his head, and here it is. Vomiting at the mouth. Some word of that. You talk too much. They rattle off too much information. It made it very easy for David to say, okay, you've obviously murdered this person. I'm going to bypass a little bit on chapter 5 because some of the things are relatively innocuous. Because there's something very, very important that's messianic that's happening in verse 6 of chapter 5. But, so I'm going to go there a little bit quickly. So I apologize if you had any questions between now and then. In chapter 5, David gets re-anointed by all the tribes. He was already anointed by God. This is nothing more than the tribes acknowledging that God has anointed David as king. David, of course, he reigns for 7.5 years in Judah, and of course, Jerusalem for the reigning of his 40 years, maybe 33 years total. This is where something really unique happens. David does something. And this is key. David goes to Jerusalem. Why did David go to Jerusalem? Why? What's the purpose? What is in Jerusalem? Not yet. Temple doesn't exist. Jerusalem is nothing more than Mount Zion is nothing more than it doesn't even belong to Israel. It's nothing more than a rock. They haven't won it yet. They haven't conquered it yet. Mount Moriah? Possibly. We don't know much about Mount Moriah. I thought you said Mount Zion. I apologize. I misheard you. I apologize. So Mount Moriah. Possibly Mount Moriah. That's one very true. The Melchizedek is somehow associated with it. Yes, Ellie?
Is he checking out the lay of the land and the water system and everything and checking out the city as a place?
It possibly. It could be just be reconnaissance or taking a look at what potential use of the city
could
are.
Could I be there? Yeah.
Let's go a little bit back and find out what's the history of Jerusalem. Why would David desire this? Say it again. Salem, yeah. Jerusalem, Salem. Jerusalem, which originally Salem. It's on a hill, yes. Holy place, well, possibly. We don't know for sure if it's a holy place or not. We don't know if Mount Moriah necessarily is there. Yeah, it's commonly believed that. We don't know that. Well, let's go back a little bit. Not too far, just a little bit. Just a short distance back. Joshua. Let's go to Joshua. No, go ahead. We read this the last time we were covering the book of Joshua. We don't have to go back and read everything about it. But something unique about this time. Joshua chapter 10 discusses the conquest of many kings, but in particular one, an Amorite king of Jerusalem. Amorites, as well, there were five kings. Could be wrong. I think there's five kings. Get together to conquer Gibeon, which is the Gibeonites, which had just struck a deal with Israel, snickered Israel into make a contract with them, thinking they were somebody else. So they identified themselves, hey, we tricked you, neener, neener, neener. And then, so they come forth, say, you made a deal with us, these other kings are upset with us, you have to come protect us. So Joshua gets all his men together, they come forth, this is the story when Joshua says, you know, sun stand still, moon, freeze, stop. That's that story, that event. It's an Amorite king of Jerusalem. Now here it discusses the Jebusites in Jerusalem. It was actually an Amorite king over a city that was populated or inhabited with primarily Jebusites. It was a conquered city at the time which Joshua had come along to take it over. It had already been conquered by the Amorites, had taken it from Jebusites. They didn't expel them. They just conquered it and took it over. He conquers this city. Kills people. Correction. Be back. Joshua doesn't conquer the city. Joshua kills the king. Judah comes along and conquers the city. Burns it to the ground. Jerusalem gets wiped out. But the Jebusites weren't expelled. In the book of Judges, discusses that Jerusalem comes along, burns the city, and leaves. Benjamin, the tribe, comes along, but instead of taking the city for themselves, they leave the inhabitants there to rebuild it. The Jebusites rebuilt it. Mind you, this is about 400 years from that event until we're discussing here at David's time. Roughly, not exactly, 350, close enough to 400 years. So Jebusites have been there at the bequest or the approval of Benjamin for quite some time. Now, that doesn't answer as to what the value this particular city has to David. All it does is tell us a little history about the city. Okay, so it's changed hands a few times. But David goes up to this city, and the inhabitants say something odd to him, which should catch your attention, because it's an odd statement. Now, granted, Bill's words this very conveniently. Unfortunately, the text doesn't actually word it as conveniently as his does. They added a few extra words. No offense, Bill, that's the nature of most texts. A couple of my books are the same thing. What was that? Reader's Digest version. Okay. He goes up, and mine says, we're not saying mine's absolutely correctly, but it's a little differently worded. So let me read this out to you. One of them spoke to David, saying, "You shall not enter here unless you remove the blind and the lame." As if to say, David will not enter here. Then David captured Zion, the fortress, which is called the City of David. David declared on that day, "Whoever smites the Jebusite and reaches the stronghold, or water tower, and the blind and the lame that David detests," mine stops. Of course, 1 Chronicles 11 finishes off his statement and says, "shall be chief and captain." Because people say, "The blind and the lame are here, and they shall not enter the house." What on earth does that mean? It seems such a bizarre... What does that say? It's very confusing. There's a million and one interpretations of what's going on here, of what the blind and the lame is referring to. I'm not talking about all million and one, I'll talk about three. First, most common interpretation... Blind and the lame refer to two particular idols that are established and built in Jerusalem at the time which David is around. It's common interpretation. Not it's right. I'm just telling you the three common interpretations. When the Jebusites are claiming, "You shall not enter here unless you remove the blind and the lame," which means you must remove our gods. Our gods protect our city. Blind and lame is what the Hebrew would call your god's blind and your god's lame. Not what the Jebusites would name their town, name their gods. But what Israel would say, "Well, it's not a real god. Our god sees. Our god can do stuff. Your god's a rock and a stone or a piece of wood. It's blind and it's lame." So that's one common interpretation. That the Jebusites saying, "Our gods protect our city. You can't enter here. You have to remove the blind and the lame first. You have to kill our gods off first," which you obviously can't do it. That's the claim. Second interpretation. The blind and the lame refer to a deal that Abraham struck with the Philistine king Abimelech, was his name, about my descendants and your descendants and how they would not interact or butt heads. They would respect each other's territory. That contract was reaffirmed by the blind and the lame, meaning blind referring to Isaac and the lame referring to Jacob with his busted hip. Contract that struck between the Philistines, which they believe were potential ancestors of Jebusites. I'll say this is right. This is a common interpretation. Ancestors of Jebusites, so that they were saying, declaring, "You have to remove Isaac and you have to remove Jacob before you're allowed to come into our city. You have to break your covenant first." That was the second most common interpretation. Are either of those right? Okay, right's hard to say. Are those make any sense? We're going to discuss that shortly. Do either of those interpretations make any sense? Yes, Bill. Defender, go right ahead.
It's like the Marines are fighting this battle, right? And the Army shows up. "Hey, the ladies have arrived." It's sort of, you know, just it's sort of a macho thing. You wouldn't understand it, you know, ladies. It's a macho thing. Our army, our little boys can beat you guys.
That's a fair interpretation, but if that was the case, my personal instinct would say, why didn't David just say, okay, bring it on and attack? Because David doesn't. David backs off. He says, all right, any one of you who are able to do it, the first one who can successfully do it, the city's yours. And of course, in First Chronicles records that Joab, David's nephew, was able to take the city. So if it was a mockery of David, which it clearly is, it's referred to David will not enter here, why would David then say, okay, I will take the mockery, step back, and ask for volunteers? It seems a little bit, I agree with you that it is a mockery, don't get me wrong. But whether it meant simply just as a mockery or whether it meant something else seems a little bit more to me, in my personal opinion. I could be wrong, just my personal opinion. I think it means a little bit more than just that. Third common interpretation. Messianic reference. My personal opinion, I have to agree with this one, but don't take that I'm right. What are the Torah rules about the blind and the lame? They can't be priests. They can be descendants, but they can't actually offer anything. They cannot enter the house of God. Right? Jebusites are claiming, and using that, by the way, I'm personally a strong believer the Bible interprets itself. So if you have a reference here, somewhere else here is its definition. So find where the other definitions or other places use the same term. The blind and the lame. Where else is listed? Actually listed in a number of different places. Isaiah lists it in particular. Jeremiah lists it. Mike, I believe, lists it as well. I don't look at Mike's reference. Yeshua mentioned it a number of times. The Torah, Leviticus mentions it as well. So let's find it. I'm going to go through all of them, don't get me wrong. We go through those and you would see a common pattern. The blind and the lame do not enter a holy place. So what do you do with them? They are allowed to receive benefits from things that are holy. They receive from the holy place, but they cannot enter it. You must get rid of them. The Messiah got rid of them by making them no longer blind and no longer lame. The Torah prescribes that they must be not allowed to enter the holy place of God. This place, the Jebusites are claiming, is holy. The King of Shalom, Melchizedek, recall, as David pointed out earlier. It's a holy place. David, you cannot enter here. You cannot make this place holy. You cannot, because this place is holy. You can't enter here. You have to remove the blind and the lame. They're declaring Jerusalem is holy, and they're saying to David, you can't enter. It's too holy. You have to do something first. Yes, Ellie?
But he's saying that you can't come in here because the blind and lame will repel you.
Mine doesn't say repel. Oh, the text doesn't say repel.
Mine does.
I'm sure yours does. The
You're
repel
saying
is
that's
what people
different.
Answer to try to understand what's
gotcha.
Going on. The repel is not
okay.
Word. The word repel is not there. It's because you cannot enter because of the blind and the lame. Period. If there was punctual things in Hebrew. You have to remove the blind and the lame before you become king of Jerusalem. David knows this is holy. If you read the Psalms, many, many Psalms, he discusses the holiness of Jerusalem. The temple wasn't built. It wasn't dedicated. Nothing even existed. But yet, David had the supplies. At the end of his life, he had the supplies somewhat partially set up or the designs built. But the city was nothing more than a town. And yet, David believed this city to be holy. The Jebusites believed this city to be holy. Apparently, a good chunk of Israel believed this city to be holy. There's something unique about this particular town. So was Mount Moriah there? Possibly. There's something unique about it up to this point that all the Israelites, and David in particular, recognized was unique about this town. So he set it aside. Yes, Jeff.
Has anything to do with the Melchizedek? Officiating there.
Yes, which was David's comment. I'm inclined to say yes, but I can't say for certain that's it. The reason that's because Melchizedek, Melch Shalom, King of Righteousness, King of Peace, is the term back in Genesis. It reads both ways. King of Righteousness, King of Peace, not necessarily King of Righteousness, King of a particular town. It can read both ways or neither way. So to say for certain it's one is difficult, though I'm inclined to believe that. Yes.
In the time of Yeshua, there was, as everybody knows, this is offensive to me. I understand your need for it, though. The priest of righteousness with the guys in the cave, I can't remember them now, drawing a blank. The Essene community, right. They had the teacher of righteousness. Many people believed Yeshua worked and studied and was the teacher of righteousness to the Essene community, because the Essene community basically disbanded about the same time as Yeshua's ministry came along,
right.
Which falls into the same parallel with Melchizedek.
Right. Which supports the issue that this is a holy city long before David built anything on it. There's something else that we're going to run across. Yes, the Mount Moriah, continue on that process. There's something else unique about this. Yeah, the smoke fire. In a few chapters from now, we're going to read something very odd that David does as a custom of his. It should catch your attention when we read it. But he does something each time he reaches the top or just past the Mount of Olives. He faces Jerusalem, though it is still not a holy city yet, and bows. Prostrates on the ground and worships God, pointing and facing Jerusalem. Now, if you recall correctly, that's common tradition now. No. Solomon, David's son, established that tradition. David didn't. Oh, sorry, that's a reference that's going to happen in a few chapters. I think it's 2 Samuel 15, 16, something like that. I forgot the exact chapter. I'd have to look it up again off the top of my head. But it's important to note that out, because that's the same tradition that the Messiah does. The same tradition. When he reaches the top of Mount Olives, what does Messiah do? He goes to the Garden of Gethsemane, which is, as is recorded in New Gospels, is his custom to worship there, just as David's custom, which, by the way, Garden of Gethsemane and just past the summit of Mount Olives is just about the exact same spot as each other. So David's custom that happened 1,000-plus years before Messiah was around, of stopping, looking at Jerusalem, and bowing down, was his custom. Messiah comes along, he goes there, says, oh, there's the same place. Goes over, stops, looks over Jerusalem, and bows as well. There, why was it Messiah's custom? Because it was David's custom. By the words of my Lord. They are symbolic of each other. We're going to get in a lot of detail about that when we get there. But unfortunately, I had to reference it now because it's important to note that these people do things that are parallel to one another. So in David's case here, when he's being accused, you can't enter because the blind and lame, whether you argue it's repelling, whether you argue it's getting rid, I don't really care. The blind and lame is the reason you can't enter. What was the reason Messiah could not become king of Jerusalem? The Messiah had to get rid of the blind and the lame first before he's allowed to become king of Jerusalem. Not death. Get rid of them. Make them no longer blind and no longer lame.
Like the blind man, now he can see?
Yeah. Jerusalem, Messiah has to do that. In David's case, when he said, the person who is able to do this, it is yours. That's what he says. Joab goes forth and does it. So Joab is able to conquer Jerusalem, but David was not. Joab became king, if you use that, or ruler of Jerusalem. He was the chief. He was the head of Jerusalem for the rest of his life. David never was. Because David didn't get rid of the blind and the lame. The Messiah, while he was physically here on earth, got rid of blind, and lame in and around Jerusalem and most of all the rest of the territory of Israel. He got rid of them. He addressed the Jebusites' claim, this is a holy city. If you wish to become king of a holy city and be holy yourself as a result, you better do something first. Blind and lame must be addressed. Take care of them first. Get rid of them. Not murder, not kill, but make them no longer blind and no longer lame. Something that David knew, I can't do. I don't have that ability. Messiah has to fulfill it. Yes, Ellie.
In verse 5, he reigned 33 years over all Israel and Judah. So you have a three, you have two threes there,
yep,
that point out in the next verses you're going to have life or death issues regarding, yep, the Messiah.
So it's a Messiah reference. Now that is a third that I happen to subscribe to, interpretation of blind and lame here. Like I said, there's like a million and one. You name it, somebody has an opinion on it. Not that anybody's is correct, it's just that's what we all have spewed out. Somebody's is probably right. I apologize for taking over you, but the stronghold of the water tower, that had to do with the blinding, the Messiah, as he cleans the one guy's eyes, it's mud and water. It's a reference of cleansing process. Making the blind and the lame clean, the water tower or stronghold. That's why he references the water tower. By the water tower, I mean by the cleansing process, you will make this town, you will address the town and take care of the blind and the lame. Yes, Anne.
You mentioned in the beginning, though, that blind and lame were idols.
That was one of the interpretations. We don't know that. As I mentioned, there were three common. One was believed that blind and lame was the Hebrew words for two idols that were on Jerusalem's, maybe the city walls or the city gates. That was one interpretation. I'm not saying that's right or wrong. That is an interpretation that somebody created. That's all I can address it. I think the third one, or second one I rattled off was, with Jacob and Isaac. But one blind, one being lame, which is the second interpretation. I'm not saying any of those interpretations are any more or less valid than the third one which I addressed. But it's just an interpretation. I personally believe the third one. That's my opinion. I apologize for taking you over time. Are there any further questions or comments regarding the section that we've discussed? Have a wonderful rest of Shabbat. God keep you safe.